Welcome, everyone, to episode number 95 of Underserved. With me in studio today is Kim Sinclair, former CIO of Boston Medical Center HealthNet Plan. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Kim, thank you so much for joining us on Underserved.
Thank you, Andrew. It's great to be here today.
So way back when at Dartmouth High School in Dartmouth, Massachusetts, what was your first introduction to computers?
That was a computer class where we had Apple IIe's, the very basics getting started. And it was something that just interested me.
I think Apple had some sort of concerted effort to put those into schools in Massachusetts, because it seems like so many people, either a digital equipment corporation, VAX, or an Apple IIe was their first time on keyboard.
Yeah, one or the other. Yeah.
So when you graduate, what do you decide to do in college?
I wanted to not do computer science. I actually went to Providence College with the idea of becoming a psychologist. So I went with a major in psychology, and that's how I started.
Go Friars.
Go Friars. Definitely. Being part of Providence College was an amazing experience from a basketball perspective, for sure.
Why was that? What were you involved in there?
I was in the PC pep band. So I joined that my freshman year, and I played the trombone. And we played for all of the home games for men's and women's basketball and men's hockey.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Did you get to travel with the team or?
We did. Every year when they went to the Big East tournament in New York, we got to go with them and we got to stay as long as they did, which was great. And my senior year, they actually won the Big East tournament. So we got to stay for the whole weekend and celebrate with everyone. And that actually got them into the first round of the NCAAs that year, which was a great experience.
Sat down in Kentucky?
It was. And that year, as the president of the pep band, my senior year, I actually got to conduct the band. And so there's a great picture of me somewhere with headset on, similar to the one I'm wearing now, with the mic, listening for my cue from the broadcasters for when it was time for us to play. So there's some really great memories from that time.
That's cool. Now, you don't stick with psychology, though. The siren song of CS keeps calling.
Yes. So I liked the idea of psychology. And then I took a computer science class and I fell in love with it right from the very first class I took, learning to write algorithms, writing code, solving problems. It really spoke to me.
What languages are you working in there?
Pascal. That was the big one. That's what I started out with. I don't remember what else we poked around with, but Pascal was the primary one I learned with.
Any professors that were particularly instructive, informative mentors?
I was lucky to be part of a great program, and it was a small program. My first professor was a man named Mike Guzzi, and he had a love for computer science, and he was the most energetic and excited about the topic. I think even people who had no interest in computer science enjoyed the class, but I learned a lot from that class, and suddenly I fell in love with computer science. And then I had a great professor, Mary Russell, who was also my senior advisor for my very first project on my own, which interestingly was HTML related. Back then, you actually had to code it all. It was just a blank sheet of paper, a blank page. I know now my nephews can, you know, put in a few commands and end up with a wholly built page.
So hand rolling like table and TD and TR tags and the whole nine?
Yes.
Yes.
A lot of things I've thankfully already forgotten, but it was painful at the time.
So you graduate and your first job's at the Massachusetts Department of Revenue?
It was. I was hired as a programmer analyst, level one, started at the bottom, and it was a COBOL shop. So I learned COBOL and all things about working with a mainframe and what it means to be part of a team and participate.
Now, are people curious about this time in your career? Do they always ask you, like, what was it like back in the before the turn of the century working on COBOL?
Sometimes, yeah, people are surprised and they're like, wow, that still exists. I get that a lot. But it did. And I think what most folks who are programmers today, newer programmers, don't realize is, you know, how many thousands of lines of code it took to do something that today would probably take you 10 lines of code to do. So it was a good way to learn.
I think the young whippersnappers today would also be surprised to hear that there are still COBOL jobs. We've put a few COBOL developers to work like this spring.
That's amazing. Not surprising. I guess those systems out there that people just don't want to part with.
you're on the critical path here, right? Like during tax season, like on pager duty and the whole nine?
Yes. So I worked on a team that was responsible for your tax returns, for processing them on the back end. So that was my first experience with anything that was 24/7, really. Each of us would end up with pager duty. So we alternated and they gave us these really heavy laptops. I don't know if anybody remembers them. I think they called them the grid, but they weighed like 20 pounds and you had to lug them. And I had to take the bus from Boston and you take this giant thing home. You wait for it to boot up and then you pray in the middle of the night that nothing goes wrong. But it's tax season and, you know, we had operators that would run the jobs. And if anything went off, then you were getting called at 2 a.m. to fix it or figure out how to fix it. So people got their tax returns. So it was an interesting learning experience.
So before you get to Y2K, you move on to Paradis Software?
I did. They were a company that doesn't exist anymore, but they did software asset maintenance. So basically, they took those old systems that nobody wanted to support themselves anymore. And they formed teams of people who that's all they did is they supported these really old systems, kept them up and running and in great shape. And they took on that company, took on an entire Y2K business, which is what they hired me into.
How was that?
It was interesting. Being a programmer, they did both COBOL and C. So, you know, I got to use some of my skills. After a while, you're tired of figuring out where the 2 digits to the 4 digits are for Y2K. But I also got the chance to do some project management there. So that was a great experience.
You mentioned in the pre-call a big customer project, like kind of all hands on deck, nights and weekends.
Yeah, I think we've all worked for a company that something's been sold that's so big with such an amazing deadline that suddenly you end up with a lot of work. And that was the case with AT&T. We had a contract with them to modify, remediate all of their code, and we had to do it by a certain date. And it had to be delivered that date or the deal was off. And I don't know, there had to have been over 30 people. We even had developers in on weekends with us in the professional services teams, nights, weekends to get this done. And I still remember when we finished it, my boss at the time was taking the completed code, driving it himself to Logan Airport so it could get on a plane and delivered the next morning. So that was an amazing experience. It was the first time I'd worked on anything like that with such a group of people really coming together to get something done. And that was just amazing.
The thing that surprises me today is that FedExing hard drives is still like the best way to do things sometimes, like online backup restorations. Like it's so much faster than trying to squeeze it through a pipe.
Oh, it really is. That's amazing. Yes, it is. Still to this day, even at work, as far as last year, wanting to exchange data with someone and someone inevitably saying, well, send it to me on a thumb drive or send it to me. It's like, okay, that's going to take a couple days. That's fine. It's easier than dealing with IT to download that file or whatever it is. That is still very much the case, even all these years later.
Sneakernet is alive and well.
It is.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Maris Consulting Group, embracing the power of people in technology. For more information, visit mariscg.com. That's mariscg.com.
Now, I remember during Y2K, like I was learning C at the time, starting to work with it more. And I remember thinking like an unsigned int in C was going to run out in like the year 2038. And that seemed so far off. But now, you know, it's within the realm of possibility.
Everything seemed so far off then. Yeah, that's very much true.
So you move on from there to the e-commerce enablers open market?
Yes, I did. I worked there for about a year. It was my first foray into an e-commerce company. I was a project manager and I was assigned a customer that was Millipore at the time. I didn't really understand at the time what they did. I was learning the business, learning the processes, learning our software, learning to write statements of work and all sorts of other things. But I enjoyed my time at Open Market. It was short though.
And where'd you move on to from there?
From there, I had someone who had moved on and one of those great people in your lives that as they move on to other places, they call you up and say, hey, Kim, this is a great opportunity. Have you thought about doing something different? And that's what happened in this case. And she'd gone to ServiceSoft, which at the time had two functions. I mean, they were doing a lot of professional services on the one hand, and then also they had knowledge management and chat software. So think like Eddie Bauer's website at the time. If you went online and wanted to search for a particular product or ask questions about it, that's the software that was used behind the scenes. So I went there and I worked on some professional services projects, building a portal for insurance for someone who I'm not sure it was ever done. We stopped the project, but it was one of those great projects where there's no business owner, there's no business requirements, but you're supposed to get it done. So that was my first experience with a situation of, well, we've agreed to do something, but we don't know exactly what it is we're trying to build. And then I had the opportunity as we released our new software, there were some challenges with it. And I was asked to be part of a SWAT team and I loved it. Working with the cross-functional teams, really digging into the issues, learning the product, learning the software and the systems that were behind it. I eventually ended up managing the customer support team there, and that was my first management job. It was something that I was very excited to try and found that I really liked.
Now, there was some M&A going on there. How did that change the landscape?
Things changed a lot. So we were ServiceSoft ended up merging or getting bought by Broadbase Software, which was based in California. And so that changed things. Suddenly, my boss worked in California and there was a great time difference. And I saw her twice a year versus the person who sat down the hall for me. So it was a real change for all of us that were in the Massachusetts office. We also saw some downsizing. Although on a positive note, the company Broadbase went public, and because we all had stock options, that was sort of the, you know, the big right before the bubble burst, I suppose, from the from that perspective in the tech market. And then Kana Software bought Broadbase, still left most folks out in California, and then added some new software to our portfolio, really around customer relationship management software, help desk software, that sort of thing. But again, you start to go through major changes, so much integration, people leave. We ended up having gone from, I don't know, 250 people in our Natick office down to 40 people. So a lot of change. And that's when for me, it was time to move on to the next thing.
Now, luckily enough, you kept your network going and someone else says, hey, Kim, want to come here?
Yes. Again, I was very lucky. Someone I had worked with at Kana had gone to work for Boston Medical Center Health Net Plan as the director of IT before there were chiefs or anything else in the organization. It was a pretty small company then. She called me up one day and said, we're hiring for a manager of the model office. Would you be interested? And I said, well, what is a model office? And it's a term that the software vendor Trizetto was using to describe like the team that took care of configuring the entire transaction processing system. So the claims processing, the enrollment systems, everything that went with it. And it sounded interesting to me. It was new. I hadn't done it before. I didn't know any more about healthcare than what you know going to your doctor about copays. But I wanted to learn. And so I started at the organization with a team of four people.
Now, claims processing and like getting the providers paid is like, you got to do it or else they're screaming. What's that like?
Oh, my goodness. That was my first foray into it. I actually started with the company about 2 weeks before they went live with the new system that they were putting in. And I got a crash course in how providers are paid, why it's important. I even got to sit through my first session reviewing printed checks. We were doing a manual check to make sure that what we were sending to our providers was actually right. So it was paramount. I mean, as a health plan that was working with for an underserved population with a lot of providers and health centers that if they didn't get paid, they couldn't pay their staff. So everything we did was critically important to make sure that worked. So there's a lot of stress at first that comes with that. But over time, we got much better at it and experienced with it and learned to do more of that.
BMC's health plan was owned by BMC, but they were kind of separate at the time, right?
Yeah, that's right. Boston Medical Center had started the health plan really as a way to bring more money into the healthcare system for those uninsured patients. And it really started off as a really hands-off business other than, you know, that we had the same overall senior leadership. We had our own HR department, our own finance department, our own IT departments. We pretty much, as I grew in the organization, didn't even know who our counterparts were at the other organization, which was interesting. At least that's how it started out.
Now, going into a brand new vertical, like, you must say, all right, I'm going to have to ask a lot of questions, stay humble, don't assume. Did that help you come up to speed there?
That was really important. I knew I didn't have the background. They gave us, when we started, they gave us a cheat sheet of acronyms that we might want to know. So I had that with me. And every day I had other acronyms I wrote down or things that somebody said in a meeting that I didn't understand. And I had someone that I was fortunate to be paired up with, another manager in IT, who would answer all of my questions. I quickly learned that just because I didn't know something didn't mean that everyone else did either, which was really important. I realized that the system was really complicated and could be configured in lots of ways. And most of our business had been outsourced, actually. So the entire, our IT systems, but also claims processing, had been outsourced to a third party. So I started to ask questions about, well, what happens in this situation? And people started asking, well, why are you asking that? Like, because you have two options in the system. And suddenly it became clear that I needed to ask lots of questions for myself, but also because others didn't realize what their options were.
I wonder if anyone knew everything about the system and what it would do at any given juncture.
I don't think so. At a high level, yes, but so nuanced. Any major configurable system like that has so many settings and so many options when you're talking about paying a claim. It was amazing the number of things you can make the system do. We were trying to do something one time. Our CFO went out and sold this particular contract to a provider group down the Cape and then came back and told us that this is what we were going to do. And that's not the way the system works out of the box. But my team and I took it back and we started thinking about how the system did work. And we realized we could reuse a different piece of the system to ultimately do the same thing, but not as its intended function. So it was great to, you know, every time you turn around, you were learning more about different ways you could actually make it function.
Then about 4 years in, you get promoted to Director of Business Systems Analysis. What changes for you then?
For me, that then I took on reporting and the data warehouse team, which from a regulatory perspective and an operational perspective was really important to the organization. We spent a lot of time on regulatory reports and other things that were due to the state. So I took that on. So I started doing reporting and data warehousing. We started actually hiring business analysts, which we hadn't before. I had a team of people who work with the business and work on requirements. And then we also started to do a little bit of project management. So things started to change. I became a director, more responsibility.
And one of the other things that changed is RomneyCare was passed around then, right? Can you tell folks what that is and how it changed things for you?
Yeah. So RomneyCare was the Commonwealth of Massachusetts version of what eventually became Obamacare. So it was trying to ensure the uninsured patients in Massachusetts. Ultimately, the goal was to get to 100% insured. That was done in a collaboration in Massachusetts between the state, the health plans, the providers. It was a lot. It was a very intense short period of time between the time the law was passed and it had to be implemented. But the state did a great job bringing up their systems. We knew what was needed and we implemented that. But that went changed our business from being strictly a Medicaid line of business in Massachusetts to now having this second line of business, which was the first for us of really thinking differently about how we did things and how our systems needed to be functioning to support more than one contract.
Yeah, it sounds like you guys were the canaries in the coal mine for the whole, like, trying to get hundreds of thousands of people that had never even had insurance before into an insurance system.
Exactly. Yes.
Syrinx has spent a lot of time and effort over the past 25 years building our reputation for quality and our brand. There was one big problem, though. No one could pronounce our name correctly.
Person on the street, brand testing, take one. Hi, can you pronounce the name of this company?
Syrinx?
That's a really good guess.
Really?
Now, how would you pronounce the name of this company?
Syrinx?
Not even close. Can you pronounce the name of this company?
Shrinks. Luckily for us, Syrinx was acquired in 2022 by the DeWinter Group. We're rebranding Syrinx under DeWinter's highly regarded technology consulting arm, Maris Consulting Group. We bring Syrinx's deep technology delivery experience, and they bring broader delivery capabilities and a new identity as Maris.
Here's what you can count on from the unified Maris. We are now a nationwide powerhouse when it comes to technology consulting, from DevOps to developers, to project managers, to business systems.
So join me in welcoming our future as Maris. Hopefully people will have an easier time pronouncing this one.
How would you pronounce the name of this company?
Maris.
How would you pronounce the name of this company?
Maurice.
Is that your uncle's name? Can you pronounce the name of this company?
Mars.
That's a planet.
Maybe not.
So contact Maris today, and we'll help you get your project done on time and on budget. You can call us at 408-297-7500, or you can find us on the web at mariscg.com. That's MARISCG.com. So from there, you move on to become senior director of IT. What changes then?
That was an interesting time. There were a lot of changes going on at the organization. The president left for another job. Our COO and CIO roles were eliminated. They brought in a temporary leader for the company, hired a COO, and then asked if I would be willing to be the senior director of IT. And for me, I had thought a few months before that I was going to go down a different path with my career and get into operations. I was fortunate to work with a great chief operating officer in my role in IT, and I was going to start working for her. And my friends joke with me that I did have that job for 9 days. And then she and my CIO left the company. So when I was asked, I had never thought I wanted to be a CIO. It just wasn't something prior to that I had ever considered. But I was asked to do it, and there was a lot of good I thought I could do for the organization, having been in IT there for many years. And so I said, okay, why not? Let's give it a shot.
But your first assignment is not very pleasant.
It wasn't. This all happened around the same time the economy took a big downturn in 2009. And in order to stay viable, the organization decided we needed to cut costs by 20 to 30%. And my first big task as the senior director of IT was to cut my budget, and that included more than 20% of my workforce.
Ugh.
Yeah, it's a great way to start a new leadership role.
Yeah, welcome to management.
That's exactly right. I was thankful, though, that I worked for an organization that really cared about the people, and we did everything we could to support them, keep them for a couple of weeks, try to make their transition as easy as possible.
Well, you got a senior director title, but you got infrastructure, you own security, development, QA, service desk, project management. That sounds an awful lot like a CIO.
It was. It was interesting. It was, you know, a senior director of IT title, which basically replaced the CIO. So everything that she had before she left, I took over and I reported to the chief operating officer. That was the big difference. I did that for about 3 years. And then the president at the time decided he wanted to think about whether or not we should have a CIO, the way technology was evolving across the industry, certainly. And we had a third party come in and do that evaluation. And they decided that, yeah, I think you really should have a CIO, especially with the growth that you're looking to do. And I made my case that that's the role I wanted after 3 years basically doing that I wanted to actually be the CIO for the health plan.
I'm already doing the job. Can I please have the title and maybe a pay bump?
Exactly. Yes. I think I've proved to myself. So, yeah.
That's cool. This reminds me of, have you seen the movie Office Space?
I have.
Yeah. I think the Bobs came in and they're like, you need a CIO.
Yes, definitely.
You also worked on your MBA around this time frame, right?
I did. Again, I was fortunate to have a leader I worked for who encouraged me that if I wanted to continue in my career and depending what I wanted to do next, that it would be a great time to consider getting my master's degree. And I really wanted to expand because I'd spent so much time working with the business and I really was interested in how the business ran. I decided an MBA was the right thing to do at that time.
You guys also went multi-state then, right?
Yes. So for the first time, we left Massachusetts and actually launched a Medicaid product in New Hampshire. And I had a colleague that would say, if you've seen one Medicaid plan in one state, you've seen one Medicaid plan in one state. And he couldn't have been more right that Medicaid might have some of the same basics, but dealing with a different state legislator or legislature, different regulations, different expectations, it was, I think, a lot more different than we expected going into it.
And so around 2014, Obamacare gets implemented. How does that change from your Romney Care days?
Oh, what I wouldn't give for Romney Care at that point. We knew going into it that, you know, there were, I don't know, it was like 800 pages of legislation that went into Obamacare. Some of it similar to Romney Care, some of it not. I think I mentioned earlier that our systems worked, the state systems worked, like everything was really seamless. But with Obamacare came this federal exchange, and they hired a consultant, a company, and to build the federal website, and the state hired the same company to build their replacement for what was in place to meet all of the federal requirements. I don't know if you remember, but I think the big headline at the time was basically, as soon as it went live, it crashed, federal and the state versions. And that program went nowhere pretty much that year. So there was a big uproar, as you can imagine, from the health plans in Massachusetts that had a stable working system, wanted to keep their members insured, and suddenly everything was in limbo. So I was fortunate enough to be part of they called it the Alpha Team. The governor had assembled a team. He assigned someone, and then the CIOs from the health plans were part of this team that met weekly to talk about what we could do, should be doing, provide guidance to the state as they hired and implemented a new system to make sure that at the end of the day, it would work just like ours had for the state, for the payers, as well as for the providers and the members in Massachusetts.
And how long was this little consortium kind of working together to try to get back to where you'd been?
It was probably a year in the end. I mean, really intensively for 3 or 4 months, where we would meet at least once a week to hear what was going on, get status reports from their vendors to understand how it was going to work.
And you got thrown another curveball, like everyone, Friday the 13th in 2020, March 13th. What was that like?
COVID, yes. We'd made a decision on Wednesday of that week, and it will forever be in my head that one of those days in history where we made the decision that we were going to close down the offices before anything got worse. And suddenly we were going to have everyone work from home. And thankfully, we had most of our call center staff at that point had the ability to work remotely. We'd given them equipment, but not all of our staff did. So in those 2 days, as we were sending people home, we were sending them with equipment from their desks. We were buying equipment that we could just have them connect and use. It was pretty much whatever we had to do to get people working from home is what we did. And we were 99% by that Friday where people were working at home.
But I gotta imagine, like, some call center folks like live in apartments or condos or shared Wi-Fi and no router. Like, how does that work?
I learned a lot during that period of time, as did our telecom and infrastructure team, where we tell them, take your equipment and plug your cable into your router. And they would come back and say, I don't have a router. We'd be like, well, what do you mean you don't have a router? Well, how do you get onto your Wi-Fi? Or how do you use your internet? And they would say, oh, well, I use Wi-Fi and it's from my building. It's like, okay, well, our systems, you can't take phone calls over Wi-Fi. Our systems aren't going to support that kind of voice traffic. It was a story like that almost every day, where somebody either didn't have the equipment or didn't know how to use it, or it was in the basement and their only available space to work was on the second floor. So I suspect every CIO out there went through the same thing with the learning curve of you just don't know what people are doing at home.
Did you get any unusual requests to IT with people shifting to work from home?
We had an amazing selection of things that came through. And I like to think that, well, it was a service desk and IT was, we tried to be as responsive as possible and as patient as possible. But my favorite story is we had a woman who called the service desk, wanted us to ship her toilet paper. And she insisted that this was important because if she were working in the office, she would have the toilet paper. She wouldn't have to buy it herself. Somehow this got escalated. The team tried to explain to her, no, that wasn't possible, but it got escalated to the manager of the service desk. And he knew someone and somehow he got toilet paper shipped to her this one time and explained to her that this is not their normal job, but this one time we would try to help her out. And she was happy and we thanked him. But it was just like a reminder of how different the work world had become when people were expecting you were going to ship them toilet paper to their house.
Yeah, I remember what a scarce and valuable commodity it had become.
I've forgotten that. Yes.
It's just that you go to the store and like there would be things on most shelves in the grocery store. There's certain things that would just have runs on them, like pasta and toilet paper. Like the paper products aisle was empty for months.
Yes. And you took whatever you could find, even if it wasn't what you normally bought. It was, that was a definite shock to all of our systems, I think.
My hack was to go to the restaurant supply store.
Oh, very smart.
But they would have the giant rolls that were like 15 inches in diameter. So not very practical.
I have to build a new bathroom to work with that. Yeah.
So how were things once people started coming back in person? Did they start trying to get everyone back in the office or?
No, we had talked about it. We had a whole task force that looked at, do we continue to work at home? Do we have people come back into the office? And our leadership team really wanted to give people enough notice if we were going to bring people back. We made a decision probably about a year in that the organization was going to become permanently remote. So we kept, probably 50 cubicles for hoteling space, but basically decided that the organization was going to work from home and that was just what it was going to be moving forward.
You probably hired people from other states too, and they're not coming in.
We did. And that was for us. We had two things happen. We had quite a few people that moved out of state during the pandemic, as I think people all over the country saw. We had a lot of people move to Florida, as it turns out, getting away from the winter. I think everyone saw that the economy, it opened up so many more options to hire people in other states. As a health plan, competing for call center staff in the greater Boston area was insane, trying to find good people. And if you started to expand it to other parts of the country, you could find really good talent. And that's what we did. And at this point, I'm not there anymore, but it's once you open that up as much as you do, it's hard to take it back.
It's hard to put the genie back in the bottle.
Exactly. Yes.
People get real used to it. And I've seen certain industries where FinServ folks, like the financial services people, want, to be able to look over your shoulder and see if you're on a browser or something. You got to be in the office. But a lot of the tech folks have resisted or even left jobs over it.
Yeah, we saw some of that as well. We were able to get some staff where other people had said, well, the company I worked for wanted me to go into the office every day and I wouldn't do it. So it was a definite shift, I think, for everyone as we looked at that.
So after around 20 years there, time to do something different. What are you up to today?
Yeah, I spent 20 years at a BMC HealthNet plan, now WellSense Health Plan, which was a great experience. But it was time to do something different. I was ready for a change. You've seen it. You've done it. I finished with the plan at the end of the year, and I've been spending some time relaxing, traveling, and starting to figure out what I want to do next. And that's a journey I'm still working on, whether I want to be a CIO or do consulting or work for a tech company, which, I did many years ago. So that's a journey that I'm still on right now.
Did you travel anywhere cool?
We went to New Zealand for 2 weeks.
That's sort cool.
Yes, when I knew I was going to be done from work, I thought, when am I going to, before I retire, actually be comfortable taking 2 weeks off to leave the country? And so we went for 2 weeks and it was a beautiful country and an amazing experience.
Are you a big Lord of the Rings fan?
I'm not, but some of our travelers were, and we saw many places that were related to Lord of the Rings. And then we had bad weather. Coincidentally, for people who were on the trip, we didn't like the bad weather. We got rained on and our flights got canceled, which meant we had to drive down to Wellington on a bus and spend an extra day there. But that's where the Weta Caves are, where they do a lot of the work. And we actually got to go for a tour and see their space and some of the things they design and how they do things. So it turned out to be a really good thing for the Lord of the Rings fans.
What was the most unusual thing you saw in New Zealand? Any wildlife? Did you see a duck-billed platypus?
I did not. What was amazing for me, or one of the best parts for me, was that there were basically no animals, snakes, or bugs that will kill you. There are no snakes. There are no poisonous animals, poisonous bugs, rather.
So it's the opposite of Australia.
It is exactly the opposite of Australia. And there are a couple people that we met, whether it was cab drivers or other people, that I've spent a lot of time in Australia, and they said that, like, this is like the safe place. Australia is not. Everything there will kill you. But it was a beautiful country, and, you know, I highly recommend it.
Now, any other hobbies, like, locally?
I like to hike. We have two dogs. So being out in the woods, going to different properties where we can, you know, hike and see what's out there in nature, that's big. I love to read. And then, yeah, we love to travel, but that's not so local.
Yep. So what kind of dogs do you have? How'd you get them?
Right now, we have a German Shepherd and a Rottweiler, and they're little. So one's 50 pounds and one's 60 pounds. We adopted them from Texas. They were found together in Texas. We didn't realize they were little versions of their breeds until they arrived in Connecticut, where we picked them up. But they're sweet. But they came with heartworm. They'd actually been treated in Texas, but not fully treated. We knew they had had heartworm, but we didn't really understand what we were getting ourselves into. And unfortunately, they needed a lot of treatment, which was very expensive, but also very tough on them. So when a dog gets heartworm, the treatment can be really dangerous. And on top of that, the treatment that they had to have meant that they couldn't really do anything for a month after the treatment. So imagine keeping a 4 or 5 year old dog on a leash all the time. You can't chase a ball. I can't let you run.
Ugh, it's like doggy hell.
It really is. And then they don't feel well either during that time. They're great now, though. The treatment worked. But for anyone out there with a dog who loves their dog, give them the monthly preventative heartworm pill, because what they have to go through and what you have to go through to support them if they do get sick and they don't die from it is really terrible.
Yeah, they're a little pricey, but they make these little chews you can get at the vet. It does require a prescription, which is kind of annoying, but, you know, it's pretty easy. My dogs, like, gobble them up every month. They know the crinkle of the sound of the heartworm chewy opening, and they're like, ooh, yeah.
Yes, treat, definitely, definitely.
What was the rescue in Texas that you got the dogs from?
That I don't know, but we've had two Dobermans in the past. This time we didn't get Dobermans, but there's a great rescue in New Hampshire, Doberman Rescue Unlimited. They're a great program. They take senior dogs as well as special needs dogs. We were able to get two Dobermans through them, our prior dogs. So they do really good work.
People who have Dobies seem to love them.
Oh, I did. I miss my Dobie. I mean, I'm happy to have the ones I have now. And we happened to see them, like I said earlier, they were found together. So they wanted to keep them together. And we thought we could give them a home. But Dobies are amazing.
So, Kim, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your experiences with the listeners of Underserved.
Thank you, Andrew. It was a pleasure to be here today.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.